Welcome to Rock and Roll Garage. Welcome to Rock and Roll Garage. Appreciate you joining me here. You know, for those of us that are a certain age, I'll just go ahead and say it. I'll be 60 here in about another couple of weeks, actually. There was a very special time in radio for me, for a lot of people my age, and even older and younger, from about 1978 to about 1983, that short time period. WHOT was hijacked by another format that was called WSRD, The Wizard. And everything that was cool in that day was on WSRD. And my favorite DJ from those days was Thomas John, and he is with me. He's with me here, man. How you doing?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you. After that introduction, I'm going to go downhill. We're going to say goodbye.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great night. Well, listen, it was certainly, it was just a great era. You know, for me, I was in high school, and everybody turned on WSRD. You know, that big thing back then was driving around. You know, you went to McDonald's. You may or may not have had alcohol in the car at the time. I'm not admitting to anything. There may have been some left-handed tobacco involved back in those days. But you guys were just the coolest thing around, man. I'm glad to have you on the show anyways.
Well, thank you. You know, people don't realize, I mean, a lot of this you don't realize, but the nature of the beast at that point was that, and hard as it is to believe, the FM really hadn't established itself.
Right.
And the AMs were still ruling the roost. And the great thing about it was when they handed the reins to Jerry Starr and said, here, have a rock station. And then he came to me and said, hey, you want to do this? We really, especially for those first few years, between 77 and 80, we really did absolutely whatever we wanted to do. And it was, you know, and it showed. I mean, people got that vibe from it. But it also, I mean, that's why it was so different, because there was nobody looking over our shoulder, because they didn't care.
Yeah.
They thought this was, you know, we got this FM station, this FM signal, we might as well put something on it.
Right.
And then, unfortunately, the irony is, then we, and then the other FMs around the country, built it up to the point where then 3 years later, they said, whoa, hold on.
Yeah.
We have a lot better signal here on the FM side. We're going to move the programming that we've been doing on AM over to the FM, where we can sell a lot more advertising, and see you guys. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's funny. It's hard to believe that FM didn't really catch on until almost the 1980s, you know.
It was damn near the 1980s, and it wasn't long after that that MTV came along.
Yeah, that's true. Right then, 1980, 1981, whatever it was, you're right. Yeah, for the listener's sake, real quickly, in 1955, WHOT was on at 1570. Then they added 101 around 1960. In 1962, it switched from 1570 to 1330. And then around 1970 or 71, WHOT became an AM and the FM. And then around 78, WSRD replaced WHOT. And that's where Thomas John and Jerry Starr and Dick Thompson and I don't know, Dick Thompson, was he with you guys then?
We were all in a very small building. So, and Jerry Starr and myself and Boots Bell, talk about rent legends, we're in an office about 10 feet square. So, you know, everybody was there. Dick Thompson was the titular head of everything. I mean, if anybody would have said, hey, you can't do that, it would have been Dick. He never did. But he was actually over even Jerry at that point.
So where, tell me where you grew up. Let's start with you at the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Canton, Ohio, home of the Professional Football Hall of Fame, which actually opened when I was in middle school. We had a big overnight at the YMCA, and then went to the grand opening of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then I went to Kent State, and I was there 2 years before and 2 years after what everybody thinks of when they think of Kent State.
I want to talk to you about that a little bit later on. Before we get out of here, I'd like to talk to you about that, but let's stay in the radio vein while we're here.
Yep. And then I was actually there, and after May 4th, as you can imagine, the vibe was kind of different, and you know, a lot of the thrill had gone out of it, and I was in a fraternity, and all my really good friends were older guys. So all of a sudden, I looked around, you know, early senior year, and it's like, they're all gone. So I started looking around for jobs, and I was actually in a continuity class, and they said, you know what? Apply for every job that's out there. You're not going to take it. And we don't want you. It doesn't matter, but just for the experience of applying. So I applied for a job at WHOT in Youngstown, which, weirdly enough, from Canton, I didn't even know there was a Youngstown. I mean, it's hard to believe, but we were all oriented north. You know, there was Canton, there was Akron, there was Cleveland, and of course you knew Cincinnati. But Youngstown, I thought, where?
Right, wow.
And so I came for the interview, and it was great. I loved the people. And at the end of the interview, they said, you know, you can have the job if you start on Monday.
Wow.
And I was in the middle of my senior year.
Wow.
So, you know, but I kept coming back, and I thought, you know, I really don't have any great connection with these people that are left. And the big part of it was a lot of the people that I was in telecommunications with who had graduated, as I said, I knew the older guys, they were working in record stores, they were selling insurance, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, I can actually go right from these classes right into real radio. So I thought about 10 minutes, and then I started that following Monday. And the great part about it was I was hired on as continuity director, which is a fancy term for advertising. I wrote all the commercials and produced all the advertising at that time. And the agencies that I worked with all had guys who taught at YSU. They taught advertising at YSU.
Right.
So after about 2 weeks of working with these guys and, you know, telling them my story and saying, well, I haven't graduated. They said, well, we have a class. I have a class. Just sign up for it. You don't have to come. Because we know you can do the work. You're doing it for us professionally.
Right.
So that's how I graduated. I picked up my last 12 hours through guys who were in agencies.
That's
funny. Yeah, I didn't feel guilty because they were right. You know, anything they would have taught me in class, they were teaching me in the workplace. And so that was great. I was able to graduate, so I didn't just quit and not get a degree. And that was it. Got out of that. And that was leading into 5 years then of advertising, which was really a lot more fun than you'd think, because Jerry and I just hit it off immediately. I mean, Jerry was the greatest mentor any human being could ask for. And he was also completely nuts. So we had a ball together, and we finally formed what we called Tom and Jerry Productions. And we started doing advertising that nobody else around was doing. We just made stuff up. And we would do the commercials first and then go out and find the clients who would be willing to let this go on the air.
Oh, that's funny.
And sell them that way. And
that's
we had
great.
A ball. We did that for 4 or 5 years. And then you talked about picking up the FM in 1971. Well, again, back to my original point. The reason we did was because WFNJ dropped it.
I see.
WFNJ in Youngstown had the FM, and they said, what the hell are we going to do with this? Get rid of it.
Wow.
So they literally gave it away.
Wow.
So HOT at that point picked it up, and they put on what they called Rockin' Stereo. And the T-shirt was a Whistler's mother in the rocking chair with speakers blowing her hair back.
That's awesome. Rockin' Stereo.
And they came to me and said, can you do the weathers on the FM? And I said, yeah, sure. Because at that point, you know, I was typing every day, doing commercials every day. I wasn't really on the radio. So this is great. So I would do 2 30-second breaks an hour doing the weather. Well, I didn't know it, but that was my audition to actually be on the radio.
Yeah.
So after about 3 months, they said, okay, we're making a rock station, but we want you and Jerry to be the daytime hosts. And I, of course, went completely nuts because I'm just a few years out of college.
Sure.
And thinking, you know, I'm going to write commercials for the rest of my life, which wouldn't have been so bad. It was fun. I enjoyed it. And it was
amazing. It's an amazing story, Tom.
I didn't think I was going to get.
It really is. Did you grow up as a radio fan when you were a kid? Did you listen to a lot of radio? Is that how you became a fan?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, I had the radio. I actually had back then, believe it or not, there was a radio that had an alligator clip that you attached to the register in your house, and it turned your whole house into an antenna.
Right. Okay.
And those little transistors. It wasn't even quite as advanced as a transistor radio. I'm not sure it had a battery.
Well, those alligator clips were around when I was in it later on too. But sure, that's what we'd say too. It's an antenna.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, but I've listened mostly to Cleveland, a little bit of Akron, you know, out of Canton. And you know, this was Beatle years. I mean, my high school years were coincided exactly with the Beatles. So I was just, I mean, that way, everything Beatles, everything British was just, you know, I was completely consumed with it, and also a huge Cleveland Indians fan. So I really listened to a lot of radio coming up. And ironically, not really with the intention of going into it, because when I went to Kent, I went as a journalism major, and I was fully intended to go into newspaper. And after about the first 6 months, my first big class, it was with a guy who had been involved in the McCarthy hearings. Mm. And I thought, wow, this is going to be the greatest thing. Well, you know, as it is now and it was then, I didn't know. He never showed up. We had a teaching assistant. And it was a class of 1,000.
Wow.
So we were in a huge auditorium, and I just got really... And it's ironic, because whatever I'd have been in, I would have been turned off by that situation. It just happened to be journalism, so that turned me off completely. And then I went in for a work-study thing, just because, you know, I just had time. And the work-study they gave me was working at the TV station and sorting scripts and doing news scripts. And then I was hooked. You know, once I got into the TV studio, the radio studio was right next door. And then I thought, oh, well, wait a minute. You know, I'm not sure newspaper's exactly the correct idea here.
Yeah.
And switched over middle and end of freshman year and went on from there to a telecommunications degree.
Well, that's great stuff. It really is. So you're at WSRD days. And by the way, I'm here with Thomas John, a WSRD DJ from back in the day and has been in radio all his life. And I mentioned just the SRD years, but he's spent his life in radio at many other stations as well. But we're talking about WSRD today. So it was who came up with the that sounder, that Close Encounters, that
sure. You know, it's ironic you say that, because I mean there was so much going on really fast, and the wizard came first, because that we wanted it to be WZRD,
right.
And somebody already had WZRD,
wizard, right.
So we had to switch to WSRD, which now seems perfectly fine. At the time, it was like really a concession.
Right.
It was like,
right.
Is anybody going to get this? But and around the same time, Doug Helton, the guy who, now this time we're talking to a Pennsylvania audience, so very quickly, the guy named Doug Helton, who was a artist for WMMS in Cleveland, he created the buzzard.
Right, sure. I think people know the buzzard.
So we had him come down, and we had dinner with him, and he's there playing on a napkin. And by the time we got done with dinner, he turned around and he said, how's this? And he handed us a wizard that was an exact combination of me and Jerry. It was scary how he had taken this big features from both of us, put it in this, and here's this wizard, and that was it. Oops, let's go. And that became the poster, and that became all the advertising, and it was the wizard. And it must have been Jerry. Had to have been Jerry that came up with the Close Encounters thing. Had to have been.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But it wasn't me.
Right. And you guys had, of course, you know, I'm a kid at the time, 17, 18 years old, 16, 17 years old. You had a feature called the 4 O'Clock High. Who invented that, if you remember, and talk about that a little bit?
Well, that I remember very well, because that was me. I was mowing my lawn in the back of my house, and it was when the old TV show 12 O'Clock High was on. And I had just seen it on a Saturday afternoon, and I went out and I was mowing my lawn, and I'm thinking, you know, it'd be cool. Because, again, you got to remember, we could do anything we wanted.
Right.
So once you came up with the idea, so I'm thinking, you know, it'd be really cool. Put either a theme or an artist all together and just play it straight through with no commercials. Put commercials at the beginning and the end so we'd still make the same amount of money, and just run it every afternoon. And when would you, well, geez, run it right when the kids are getting home from school.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to get on the bus. They're going to come home. You're going to catch them before dinner. That'd be perfect. Do it at 4 o'clock. And then as I'm mowing, I thought, 4 o'clock high. And then, you know, oddly, I mean, it'd be nice to say that I did it because of getting high on drugs, but really that was a corollary. After that, I said, oh, you know what? That also means...
Right.
It was really because of the TV show.
Sure.
And then, you know, the more I thought about it, I was like, this is perfect. You know, this is going to be the opportunity to put together greatest hits albums for people who don't have greatest hits albums. So if you turn this on for a half hour every day, you're going to get everything significant that artist has done. And if, on the other hand, we're going to do people who died, it'll be death songs, it'll be drug songs, mm-hmm. it'll be fire songs, it'll be whatever would come up in any given week. And if it got to the point where if there was a big concert, it would be the three acts that were in that concert would each get 10 minutes in a half hour. It was a half hour long, ran every afternoon at 4. And, you know, the weird thing about me, who knew? I did it because it was really fun and I had a ball with it. But then as the years passed, I talked to a guy who was sitting in a traffic jam on the LA freeway, and he heard the wizard tones in the car next door, and they were stopped, and he yelled over, and he's waiting, and the guy was from Youngstown, and he had a 4 o'clock high on cassette in Los Angeles. Another guy told me He took the 4 o'clock high to the top of Mount Everest.
Wow.
He said he had one on tape. And the weirdest part was there's a bar apparently in Jamestown, New York.
Right.
That recorded every single 4 o'clock high.
What?
Every day on cassette. And they had a huge rack on the wall. And if you came in and bought the house, bought everybody drinks, you got to pick the 4 o'clock high that would run for the next half hour.
Oh,
it was like a gigantic jukebox.
Funny. Wow, what a story.
So, I mean, who knew? I mean, all that stuff was way beyond what I had, had any dream of it becoming.
Well, and you know what? I mean, that's kind of really what formed FM radio. I mean, when you and I were kids, and I'm a little bit younger than you, but like you said, AM radio ruled the roost, and you really only got to hear the hits, and occasionally it was a big deal if you got to hear the B-side. You know, ooh, it's a B-side.
Oh, God, yes.
But
yeah.
FM really enabled you to, and at the same time, albums were starting to sell. And so you knew the songs from the album. You know, everybody
and
had
it. Absolutely. You know, everybody had the album and knew what they listened to and wished everybody else had heard. And all of a sudden they had a chance to hear it. And not only was it AM radio, but what I think was the beauty of AM, but on the other hand was the weakness. Except for country, everything was on the same radio station.
Right.
So when we were growing up, the AM radio station would go from Something Stupid by Frank and Nancy Sinatra to Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, The Wonderful World by Satchmo. I mean, really, all those things were on the charts at the same time. Hello, Dolly.
Right, sure. I remember listening to WFAR.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that the 4 o'clock high was supposed to be an antidote to. You know, it was like, tune in. If you like Bachman Turner Overdrive, stick around. Because for the next 7 songs, it's going to be Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Yeah, that's great stuff. It really is. I'm here with Thomas John, WSRD DJ. So let's talk a little bit about the scene back then. The Agora Theater was the Tomorrow Club, and then the Agora Theater, of course, changed to that. It was the scene, Youngstown. I had many great nights there. Talk a little bit about what that was like for you guys.
Well, it's unbelievable. People can't even begin to grasp it. I mean, if you tell someone now that we had a national act each and every Sunday night without fail, a huge national act.
Right.
I mean, the equivalent would be absolutely unthinkable today.
True.
And there were a lot of reasons for that. The major reason was there was no MTV yet. So the record companies would subsidize all these groups to go out on tour. Because the only way to get seen was to be out in the bars. And then when you came into town, then the radio station would probably add the record.
Right.
So as a result, places like the Agora seated, 2,500, 3,000 people. They were able to bring in huge acts.
Right.
Because the record company paid 3/4 of the bill.
Hmm.
And then they would come back again, and they'd pay half. And then the third time, you had to pay out all, and then they wouldn't come back anymore after that. But along the way, I mean, we had everybody, Bob Seger, Kiss. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, the Police. And they responded to it in different ways. I remember Pablo Cruz came to the Agora the day that their album went number one. And they weren't happy. This was not what they had intended.
Because it was a small venue? Because it was so small?
Exactly. And it was Youngstown, Ohio.
Right, you're not in Cleveland or Pittsburgh.
They made no bones about it. They were really pretty crappy about it. And, of course, they sunk like a stone after that album. I wasn't really upset
right.
when that happened. And then, on the other hand, Pat Benatar was at the Agora the day she was on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Wow.
And also her birthday, which is also my birthday.
Wow.
So
memorable night.
We commiserated on the fact that we had the same birthday. And she was really cool about it. There she was. And she autographed it for me. There she was, cover the Rolling Stone, and she's playing the Youngstown Agora that same night.
That's what was your birthday? You didn't get to make out with Pat Benatar or anything, did you?
No. Okay. It'd be a much better story, Eric, but unfortunately.
Yeah, right. It's funny. In the same vein, I saw Joan Jett a couple years later than that, probably about 80 or 81. I saw Joan Jett there right when, like a week or two before I Love Rock and Roll had hit Youngstown. And she screamed at the end of her show, I love, and we kind of stood and looked at each other, and she swore at us for about 30 seconds, played the song, and stormed off, and she was mad that we didn't know But a couple weeks later, we know, oh, I love rock and roll, but good stuff.
Well, I remember when she showed up with the, when they were the Runaways.
Or, yeah, yeah.
And you talk about attitude. Oh, my God. Those five girls had, oh, my God.
That was incredible.
I mean, that's where they were the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and Beethoven. All
wrapped into one. So would you guys MC those shows? How did that work with the radio station? Help the audience, my listening audience, understand how that worked. You guys were the MCs, and did you have the bands? Yeah.
Yeah, we would go every Sunday night. We would go there like 8 o'clock, and we'd go downstairs, talk to the band, find out what they wanted to do on their intros, and go out and introduce the opening act, whoever that might be. Usually, you know, sometimes Left End, Coconut, one of the local bands. Once in a while, there'd be double.
Norton Nardini.
And you go out and you just introduce the band. And, you know, I only have a couple professional regrets. One of them is that I thought it was too cool to take a little Kodak with me.
Oh, yeah, right.
But, oh, my God. You know, now I look back, and I mean, great. I have the memories of Greg Allman and Sting, and but I don't have, and it's not proof exactly.
No.
I mean, it's not like I had need to say
it.
I'm telling the truth.
Sure.
But, I mean, the pictures that we could have had, but it wasn't cool. You know, it wouldn't have been cool to say, "Here, guys, can we take a picture?"
Sure.
And so it never got done.
Yeah, that would be an incredible collection of photos, to be sure. You know.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, and you know, the Southern rock acts, without exception, were just incredibly cool. And just nice guys, and the Outlaws, and the Marshall Tucker Band, and Sea Level, and all up and down the line. And then, you know, you get the Romantics, and those kind of bands were edgy, but they weren't nearly as edgy in the locker room as they were on stage.
Sure.
They turned out to be really, really pretty nice guys. And, I mean, you never knew. Tim Curry, who people don't remember, actually had a couple albums. Tim Curry of Rocky Horror Picture Show, and then a million movies after that. And he came to the Agora, and it just happened. At that time, I used to movie reviews for six stations around the country, and I had read that he was playing Shakespeare in a limited series on the BBC in England. So I went downstairs and introduced myself and said hi to him. And I said, "How's that Shakespeare thing?" And oh my God, he just freaked out because he was so used to being asked about Rocky Horror over and over and over. He just thought that was the coolest thing. So he went on, we talked for a half hour on the story of Shakespeare and how he was playing him on the BBC.
Funny.
And the stories literally are endless. Linda Blair was there one night because she was dating Rick Springfield. And the last thing you expect when you go to introduce Rick Springfield is to look at the top of the stairs. And there's Linda Blair. This was three or four years after The Exorcist.
Right. Wow. He was on, I was just watching TV today, one of the noon 1 o'clock show. I don't even know the name of it, but he was just doing a version of Jesse's Girl today on TV. That's
no,
funny.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
What are the odds of that?
Right. What are the odds of that? That's funny. Anybody ever party too much to play there while you were there? You know, anything like that?
Oh,
happen?
My God. I can't believe you said that. How could you know this?
Okay. Well, it's rock and roll.
A great story. Ronnie Spector, who was, of course, with the Ronettes.
Yep.
And then was doing a solo thing. She showed up. She was so just completely wiped out. So they got her manager got a chair and put a tall bar stool, and she went out and put her on the bar stool. And then I go out, I introduce her, and the band were these guys, these younger guys, because by then she was in her 40s probably, and these younger guys, and they get to they start doing Leader of the Pack, and they're supposed to say, "Is she really going out with him?" And Ronnie's supposed to reply, okay?
Right, right.
So the guitarist comes up and says, "Is she really going out with him?" And she's just literally like a deer in the headlights. She's just looking around and wavering back and forth on this stool. Finally, boom, she falls off the stool, crash on the floor. And the manager comes running out, picks her up, puts her back on the chair. And everybody's like, "No, we can't do this." "No, no, she'll be okay. It'll be fine."
Wow.
So she finally manages to stumble through this show. And then it was like 3 days later in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, we have a story that they're claiming that she was on cold medicine.
Right, sure, Robitussin, yeah.
Exactly. It was Robitussin. But that's funny you say that. I mean, that's the only time. I mean, there was a lot of people who were three sheets to the wind, but they were used to it. That's how they performed. They knew how to handle it.
I never saw Eddie Money play sober, actually, the three or four times that I saw him.
Exactly. Yeah. And he played like 900 times.
Right. He was every other week. You were like, it's Eddie Money again. That's exactly. Funny. In fact, the last time I saw him at Conneaut Lake, about 5 or 6 years ago, he was pretty hammered, and he would sing one or two words, and then he would hold the mic out for the crowd
to sing.
Well, he did it every song for three quarters of the song. He would hold the mic out for the crowd to sing. It's pretty bad. Hey, I'm here with Thomas John. We're going to take a short break here now. More with him in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. We're going to talk about Left End and a little bit about Kent State too. Stay with us. Welcome back to Rock and Roll Garage. I'm here with Thomas John, and we're discussing the old days, the music scene in Youngstown, to be sure. So Patsy Palumbo was with me, Thomas, a few weeks ago. He wrote a book about his days with Left End, which was really great.
Yeah.
And I know that you guys were involved with them as well. You guys were maybe one of the reasons they made it so big regionally. But talk a little bit about Left End.
Well, you know, it was funny because as we kind of alluded to, you know, I moved here and I didn't know anybody, and I was actually lived at the Y for a while, and then I got an apartment, but I didn't know anybody. And the sales manager at the station at the time was part owner, was called The Apartment. It was on South Avenue.
Right.
And it was a bar, and it was the big rock band bar at the time. So, you know, this was perfect. I had nothing else to do. I didn't know anybody. So I literally lived at The Apartment. Well, Left End was the big band coming up at that point. Ironically, I had seen them a couple times in camp because they had, you know, they traveled obviously recently. And so, you know, I was a great fan before I came here. And then all of a sudden, I hear, oh, I know that dude. I actually got to know him. And it was... Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I had no experience with anything like that. You know, growing to the point where it was going to become a regional and maybe a national situation, and the albums were great. And you know, we were involved. There were just a couple of things. At one point, they wanted us to do an intro tape for them that they could play in bars when they didn't have anybody to introduce them. So recorded one of those, and it was like a certain preacher, you know, railing against rock and roll, and then that was what the thing was. And that thing, it's far surpassed my ability to ever play with them. They were using it for 10 years after we stopped introducing them.
Right.
Yeah. And that was fun. But the best story was that at one point they were going to play their first gig in Cleveland, which was a big deal because they were moving over into another market. And their whole point, they did in all their pre-publicity, all their advertising was that they were just the guys you love to hate. They were going to be obnoxious. They were going to be jerks. Which is ironic because Dennis Ozanski, Dennis Jimenez, had that persona on stage.
Yeah.
There was not a sweeter human being on the planet than Dennis. I mean, he was absolutely hit the switch and turned it off when he got off stage. He was just the nicest guy. So anyway, they're going to play their first gig in Cleveland. And Steve Friedman was their manager at the time. He came up with the idea that they were going to go in this bar and they were going to just berate the audience constantly. And it's after every song, you know, boy, you guys are jerks.
Right.
Boy, I can't believe you people paid just to come see us and all this. Okay. Well, there's a huge rope, probably 3-inch, hanging from the mic stand. And it goes off stage and around the back and into the backstage area. Well, they got a gorilla costume. So I get to wear the gorilla costume.
What?
So I'm backstage, the whole set, the rope is tied to a chair, and Dennis keeps tugging on the rope, and no one knows, you know, why he's doing this, but he's berating the audience, he's tugging on the rope, and he finally gets to the last song of the night. Well, I haven't done that. I mean, I've introduced some bands, but I've never done anything like this on stage. So the adrenaline is just pumping like crazy. So I take the rope and I put it around my neck, And he's supposed to, I left the part out. He kept showing this box, this cash box, about, you know, look at you idiots, look at all the money you gave us. And he opened up, and there were like $200 in dollar bills in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, so the point was supposed to be, I was supposed to come out, attack Dennis, pound him down, take the box, and then throw all this money out to the audience, which was a great idea. Well, first of all, I come out, I'm so pumped up that I hit him, and he goes down, and I start pounding on him, and he's laughing, and he's more, but but everybody thinks I'm killing him.
That's hysterical.
So I keep pounding on him. Finally, he's in submission. It was a great gorilla costume, by the way. This was not cheapy stuff.
Right.
It really looked like a gorilla. So there he is. So now, all this thing has been greatly planned from the beginning. Everything's ready to go. I go around, I reach down, I pick up the box, and then I realize I got these stupid gorilla glove hands on. So I can't, at this point I'm just, I'm being the gorilla, and I'm like, what am I going to do? So I try to open the box. The box falls out of my hands, falls on the stage. A fat white girl grabbed it and took off out the door.
Oh, God.
And was never seen again. She got the $200. She got the box, and everybody thinks it's part of the show. You know, so everybody's
right.
Cheering.
Yeah.
But Friedman's having a heart attack.
She took the money. Oh my God, that's hysterical.
He could have done that with $4 in newspaper.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Old Meadowlark Lemon trick. The old fake box.
Exactly. But I dropped it, and this fat blonde grabs it, and off she goes.
Unbelievable.
And I'm watching, and I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to kill me. And then naturally, by this time, Dennis is up. It's just freaking out, and everybody's enjoying it.
It's spectacular. You know, Patsy said in the book, he writes at the beginning, he says, I'm not going to talk about these incidents. And he names like 10 one-word incidents. He said, here's the ones I'm not going to talk about. And I always wondered what those were. And maybe that was one of them that you just mentioned, but I don't remember him writing about that. But I remember thinking the stories that are untold are usually better than the ones that are told. But,
I know what some of those stories would be.
Yeah.
That was wise.
Right. Yeah. That's funny. You know, there was a Pine Hollow Boulevard here in Sharon. Y103 was here for many years. It's in Youngstown now. But there were they had their own little scene there in the early 70s. WIFM. They were an alternative station.
Sure.
And there are rumors of lots of partying going on in that building back in that era. Was it was that the case with you guys at SRD? Was there a party there at night or in the evenings or whatever?
There were some stories that woke up, but very few. I mean, you count them on one hand. That could not be repeated, but that actually happened at that. Now, you got to remember, for part of those years, we were on Knox Street, or not Knox Street, on Blaine Avenue,
mm-hmm.
which was like 200 feet from the mill and in the middle of a junkyard and across the street from Oakland Field. So this was not exactly palatial digs.
Right.
You could lure groupies to it. It was more like, I'm not going there because I'm afraid I'll never come out.
Were girls showing up at the station? Were they? Because I know they used to do it back in the day at Y103, and even before that, back into the 50s, there's stories of girls showing up there when Woody Waddell would play, who was a famous cowboy singer. But was that the case with you guys? Were girls showing up at the station or no?
No, not really. I mean, by that time we were all married. All
yeah.
three of us were married.
Right.
Everybody was married. And I think we didn't do that in the bars. I mean, I went from doing the Agora to doing trivia nights in the bars. I started doing trivia nights at one point. I was doing 5 a week.
Wow!
And but you do that until 2:30 in the morning. You're not ready to hang out after that.
Yeah, right. You're done.
You're getting out. You're getting home. So no, there really wasn't. Certainly not stories of bacchanal and wine in the streets and that sort of thing really
yeah.
didn't go on. I'm sorry. Would have been great
yeah.
stories.
Right. Well, you guys were, I guess maybe part of that was that you guys, and maybe listeners don't know this, and I wasn't really aware of it at the time, that you guys were automated. Talk a little bit about how that worked.
Well, it was, it didn't change. Basically, what it changed was we were doing other things. I mean, I was still the continuity director while we were doing that. So what they called voice tracking, and it came to be called voice tracking. At the time, it had no name because we were like the first to do it.
Yeah.
But it was basically the music was, we knew exactly what each category of music was, what should play in the middle of the day, what should play at different day parts, and they were put on big reels. And then we would put five reels up, and each one as it ended would trigger the next reel. Well, obviously, if you think about it, there was no way to program it cut by cut.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you just hoped that you had put together the categories sufficiently. So they, and weirdly and amazingly, you know, this was all Jerry. Jerry Starr had put together that, I mean, it was very, very unusual for something jarring to happen. I mean, it just flowed. And then the new stuff, which were the new album cuts, we'd do four of those an hour. And those we would actually put the introduction on the record. So, you know, if you're, you know, here's Rush on WSRT. You think, wow, why didn't you say something else? Well, it's because you only said it once.
Right, right.
And so, and so you made them as short and unmemorable as possible so nobody would notice that you always said the same thing going into that record. And they didn't stay new that long. You know, they'd be new a couple months, and then they'd get added to one of the reels.
Sure.
And then the rest of the time, we would, every break, we would do, you know, liners, concert calendar.
Yep.
Promos
well.
For the 4 o'clock high, promos for the album hour, promos for the artist profile. You know, that stuff you could do. It didn't matter where it showed up in the hour. And, you know, nobody really noticed. We never gave the time. Forget it.
Right. You couldn't, sure.
If it wasn't the 4 o'clock high, which you assumed was somewhere around 4 o'clock, you know, you never gave the time.
Yeah.
And no one noticed. But you couldn't, because you had no idea when these things were going to run. And plus the fact that there were three of us, and except for the fact that we didn't have a morning show, this was still, as we talked about before, they didn't have that much faith in the FM, so they didn't want to give up the AM morning show. In fact, they wanted to promote it. So we simulcast the AM morning show. What we ran from 6 to 10 in the morning was top 40 music. It was Madonna. It was Janet Jackson. It was so jarring. It was always amazing to me that more people didn't complain.
Would that have been AC McCullough at the time?
It was AC. AC was doing morning show.
Right, sure.
And yeah, and AC is great, but the music was like, what?
Right.
It literally just flipped a switch at 10 o'clock, and the do-do-do-do-do came on, and from there on, it was completely different until 6 o'clock the next morning.
You know, I have a feeling that most of your listeners weren't up at that point anyway, so nobody probably even knew.
Apparently, that's it.
Yeah, you start listening about 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. when I came on, that was getting up time.
Yeah, right. You know, morning, what's that? You know, when I was a kid, so irrelevant. Amazing stuff.
Because we were voice-tracked, we were able to do huge chunks of on-air. I was on the air from 10 to 5 every day.
Wow.
7 days a week. And Jerry was on from 5 to midnight, and Mark was on from midnight to 6. And, you get a lot of air time, a lot of exposure in really a relatively short amount of time. I mean, we really only did it from 77 to 83.
Yeah.
Which isn't all that long.
Right. No, it's a very short time period. I remember being just heart crestfallen, heartbroken when I clicked it on one day and it was WHOT, and I was like, oh no, what happened?
That wasn't a good day for us either.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I talked to, you know the name, for the listener's sake, I talked to the engineer, Wes Boyd, recently.
Wes Boyd.
Yep. And he's got encyclopedic knowledge of Youngstown radio. And I said, Wes, what happened? How wasn't there any advertising? You know, usually when you have to look at the financials when you see a station disappear. And he said, well, what we had was bars and speaker places and custom sound type places that would do big advertising campaigns and then never pay their bills. So was that the case? Were you having trouble doing collectibles?
Well, yeah, it was absolutely. I mean, we had every bar we had. And at that time, luckily there were competing sound companies. You had Audio Warehouse and Custom Sounds. And so they were battling constantly. So we got a couple of car dealers, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But forget about it. You were never going to get the Sears. You were never going to get Hills at that time. You were never going to get Pennies. You know, you were never going to get that, ever. And it didn't help that the sales department didn't get it. They didn't get what we were doing at all. And, of course, that was our take on it at the time. You know, damn it, if we just had some salespeople who got it, it could work. I don't know if it could have or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe not. But the bottom line is, you know, the mainstream advertising that they knew was just sitting out there, and all they had to do was switch the AM signal over to the FM. They would quintuple their signal, and, you know, and it worked. I mean, Hot FM 101 at that point then just went on and was just a juggernaut.
Yeah.
Once it had that signal to work with.
Yep. Yeah. The Wes says when they flipped the switch, it almost immediately became number one in the whole region. And,
Yeah.
And, you know, and there was some competition, like you said, with the buzzard in Cleveland, because that signal boomed, you know, into Cleveland, and it was 101. And so, you know, in the days, according to Wes, in the days before digital radio, when you went to 101, you found Hot 101.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't find 100.7. Yeah.
Yep. Depending on which side you were coming from, which one you got first.
Yeah, it's really an amazing story, and it's really a big part of rock and roll history. We have just maybe 3 or 4 minutes left here, Thomas. I want to hear briefly about you told me you were there during the Kent State incident. Talk about that briefly for me.
Yeah, it was, you know, obviously it's something you cannot possibly prepare for, something you cannot possibly, you're absorbing it as it's happening. And I happened to be in a whole other story, but I was in a one-person class with a professor. It was me and the professor in an office in the class every day at noon. And the phone rang, and I could tell the look on his face something was really wrong. And he hung up, and he said, "We have to evacuate." I said, "You mean the building?" He said, "No, the campus."
Wow.
So we took off downstairs and, of course, didn't evacuate. I went across, which was only maybe 100 yards, went across to where everyone was now gathering, which was the opposite side of the hill where the students had been shot. And you're getting, and I, you know, I've always regretted this because I was actually working on the TV station at the time. So I felt like I was relatively cosmopolitan. So I come to this girl is hysterical. She's screaming, she's crying. She says, they shot him, they're dead. And I go, "Let's relax." I said, "There can be a lot of blood and they may not be dead." Of course I was wrong. And right. We ended up on the side of this hill, and you look down through the trees, which is maybe 500-600 yards to the street coming from Ravenna, and there were tanks coming by. I mean, this is not what you expect on your college campus.
Right.
And there's this one tank after another going by, and you're like, "Oh, you know, oh my God!" And then there was a noise of some kind that someone thought was a gun being cocked, and one person started to run, another person started to run, and you know, you hear about mob mentality.
Yeah.
You don't get to be in it that often. There were probably 1,000 of us on that hill, and all of a sudden, all 1,000 people just flowed like a wave over to the other another hill on the other side, where we thought we were safe, and just stuff like that. And everybody was told to leave. Everybody had to leave. Well, I lived off campus, so I didn't have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm walking, I get back to my dorm or my fraternity house, and I get a phone call, and it's the TV station. And he said, "Can you come in?" I said, "Yeah, definitely." Because, you know, you think you're in the spark. And by that time, the guard was everywhere, and everybody was with the rifles. So put my head down and walked across campus, not looking either way, and got to the studio and got in there. And they said, "Okay, you're going to anchor," because everybody else had gone home. There wasn't anyone. I was only a sophomore.
Wow.
And so this was TV. So I sat down. They had one of those big whiteboards that you see, like, on Criminal Minds.
Mm-hmm.
And as the afternoon progressed, it changed from the number of people that were killed, the number that were wounded, and the wounded went up and the killed went down until it ended up with 4 and 13. And that was it. You know, there's, okay, now we have to go too. Everybody's got to be gone. And on the way in, this was always freaky, the national media weren't allowed in. So I don't even remember the guy's name. It was one of the guys that you saw all the time on NBC doing stories. Mm-hmm. And he came to me and said, "Can you get me in?"
Wow.
No, I don't think so.
He wanted to get you in. When you say in, you mean even in the on campus?
In the building. No, they were on campus.
Okay.
He wanted to get in because this was like the nerve center at that point.
Sure,
it was as I say, that's just where they were keeping
He wanted to get you in the TV station. Wow.
And he wanted to, you know, and we were, you know, and, you know, so I walked out of that, and again, didn't have to leave, went back to the fraternity house, almost everybody was gone. We had just bought food for 24 guys for 2 weeks. So we had 24 guys worth of food in this building. So I stayed in the fraternity house for like 2 weeks, or like four of us. And we just made gigantic hamburgers and,
right.
And waited and finally got out and went home mid-May and got a job and worked all the way till the following year. We had to go on to campus to hotels to take our finals.
Wow. Were classes canceled then from, what was it, I guess May 4th would have been the date?
Right.
It would only be a couple weeks left, but were they canceled then the rest of that year?
They were kind of canceled. They said we did go back and take final. And okay. We were going to the Holiday Inn in Kent.
Wow.
And you went in and you took your final exam. You know, all this stuff. Now it would have been Zoom. You know, it would have all been done online. But that wasn't an option. So you had to go back. And then they set up a committee for nonviolence or something. And somehow I got on that. I don't know. I don't think I've talked about this in years. And I don't even remember how.
Hmm.
But it was like professors and policemen and teachers. It must have been because of the TV station.
Sure, you're a media guy,
that committee. And, you know, we would meet at the golf course just outside of Kent. We met, I think, three times that summer, just trying to come up with something. I mean, what do you do? You didn't cause it in the first place. It could never be, those situations would never be replicated. But somehow you had to come up with plans in case it happens again. It was a very weird time. As I say, you know, it kind of took the blush off the rose of being in college. So it wasn't hard for me to leave a year and a half later when I got a chance to actually go off and do what I was going to college for.
Wow. That's an amazing story. It really is. Thomas John. Hey, listen, man, we just have maybe a minute or so here before we get out of here. I so much appreciate you spending this time with me. Anything you want to say before we get out of here?
No, I just appreciate Henry Paul of the Outlaws had one of my favorite lines of all time when he was in town just two or three years ago, and I was interviewing him as you were interviewing me, and I said, here's Henry Paul, and he said, well, what's left of him?
Yeah, right.
I thought that was the greatest line ever, and I think that's kind of the way I want to look at it. You know, this, I'm what's left of Thomas John.
Yeah. Well, listen, you may be, you very possibly are one of the reasons that I'm doing radio here. You were always, I always enjoyed you on the air, and I too have some 4 o'clock highs on cassette still at home, ELO and a few of them. And so I will play for the listener here a short clip after I let Thomas go, and after this commercial break, I'll play a short clip from it's an air check from WSRD with him in the day. Yeah. So, but, hey, listen, man, thank you. I appreciate everything. I appreciate talking to you. It was a great conversation, a lot of fun.
Thank you very much. I loved it.
Yep. Have a great night. You know, when you get a chance to interview a guy that had that kind of a big influence on you, it's always fun, and what a great interview. So, hey, don't go anywhere. More of Rock and Roll Garage right after this short timeout. Hey, my first guest was Thomas John. If you're a little bit too young or too old to remember who he is, this is a short sound bite from WSRD, which is now WHOT in Sharon. Thomas John was my favorite DJ in the day. And they were doing really a different kind of radio than anybody had ever done. AM radio was two-minute songs, DJs that were really peppy and happy. And these guys were just, you know, kind of laid back and kind of cool. And it was really, that kind of radio was really, believe it or not, was innovated in this region. WPIC-FM and WHET Wizard were really on the forefront nationwide of that kind of a radio. We forget how influential this region was between here and Cleveland in music. It's the reason the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland. And so listen in to, this is just a short minute or so of Thomas John, recording from Thomas John on WSRD sometime between 1977 and about 1982 or 83. Listen in.
Tomorrow night from 11 to midnight, you'll get out of the weekend as Mary Turner goes off the record with Stray Cats. Interesting band, Americans who went to England, made it in England, and then came back to America as an import. I'll tell you all about it and play the music too. That's going to happen tomorrow night, 11 to midnight. Stray Cats off the record with Mary Turner on WSRD. If you find it hard to make it from weekend to weekend without a party stop in between, then you'll want to head to the arcade, Fifth Avenue. Because at the arcade, there's something every night of the week, Monday through Sunday. Tonight it's no covered draft beer night with the Hearn Brothers Band. There's no covered charge at the door, plenty of beer at the bar, and of course the sounds of the Hearn Brothers Band on stage. Then tomorrow it's time to forget the books for one night and join in the craziness of the arcade's pre-finals party with Wild Horses. Saturday brings the weekend and the sounds of Savannah. Sunday, it's another draft beer night with an encore performance by Savannah. And then on Monday, it's the ever-hysterical Charlie Wiener. Remember, some places are only made for partying on the weekends. The arcade has something going every night of the week.
From the Legacy Financial Strategy Studios, online at leavealegacy.com. News Talk 790 WPIC, Sharon Hermitage, a Cumulus station.